Organization Day starts off with a fierce debate. Governor Holcomb's pick for Education Secretary, plus the first ever state equity chief, and more on Indiana Week in Review, the week ending November 20th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Republicans rejected an effort to require House lawmakers to wear masks during the upcoming legislative session. Democrats proposed a House rule to require members to wear a mask while on the floor, in the hall, or in committee and conducting official House business, or potentially face a fine, censure, or other penalty. Republican Representative Matt Lehman called the proposal a slippery slope.
And I don't want to go down the path where your individual actions, I can bring you on this House floor and censure you. Right now that's reserved for the most heinous things, which are you don't do your duty.
Democratic Representative Ed Delaney was furious.
Well, if we shut down because we play this game and become a hot spot, will we have done our job to the public?
Only two of the more than 90 House lawmakers in attendance Tuesday refused to wear a mask. Both are Republicans. Why not mandate masks in the House? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, why not just make masks mandatory for members?
Well, because the only two people literally in the entire building who weren't wearing a mask on Tuesday were the two people that brought the resolution to rescind the governor's emergency order altogether. They weren't having a conversation about masks. They wanted all of this done. They wanted no restrictions on gatherings. They wanted no mask mandate. They didn't want any of it. And so the problem is you could have mandated to try to bring those last two members into the fold with the other 148 that were all wearing masks to session on Tuesday, in addition to staff, in addition to lobbyists and guests and family that were in the building. But it wasn't going to make any difference. And it's become a proxy fight. I mean, this is a proxy political fight on masks. It's overblown. It was overblown at the national level. You can't go nearly anywhere in society right now and walk into a place of business or elsewhere, a school, or anywhere, much anywhere else without wearing one. So, I mean, the political proxy fight is theater on the floor. But if you would have mandated it, the two guys that weren't wearing masks weren't going to do it anyway. And the legislature's limited on their ability to enforce things on legislators, particularly when they're in session.
Yeah, Ann Delaney, I mean, I mentioned more than 90 House lawmakers in attendance, all but two. In the Senate, I believe mask wearing was 100%. Have we essentially reached a mask mandate without actually having a mask mandate anyway?
I think having a mandate sends a message. I mean, you know, you still watch. I saw on TV the other day that Mike Pence had a meeting of the coronavirus task force, and sitting around the table, everyone was wearing a mask. Was Mike Pence wearing a mask? I don't think so. So, I mean, you're sending mixed messages to people when you do this. If we had a mask mandate, we would tell everybody that we think it's important and we think it's worth enforcing. And it's not true that everybody's wearing it. Everybody who has any brains and who trusts in science is wearing it. That's true. But if you go to a demonstration on behalf of Donald Trump trying to steal the election, they're not wearing masks and they're super spreaders. And if they all stay together and only interacted with each other, that would be fine. But then they go out and they spread that virus among people who do believe and are wearing masks and can still catch it if you get close enough and the circumstances are right. So I think the problem is Republicans have decided that science don't count, and they want to express this in terms of freedom. It's nonsense. It is absolute nonsense, and they should have passed.
Nikki Kelly, the Democrats on the floor raised the idea that this is similar to what Ann just said, which is this is about sending a message. This is about leadership. And it was pointed out staff are required to wear it. Reporters are required to wear masks. And everywhere else you are in the State House, you were required to wear a mask because the governor's mask order extends to basically everywhere else in the State House. So is it sending a mixed message by just the leadership saying, well, we strongly recommend mask wearing?
to me, it's all about perception. You know, when Joe Schmo walking in off the street to go to a committee hearing has to wear one, the fact that they are treating themselves differently, saying that they don't have to. I mean, yes, the vast majority did wear them, and that's great. But, you know, that was on one day when everyone was watching. We have no idea what this is going to look like in January when people are running to and fro and going into committees. And so I just think it's a perception problem that they didn't need. You know, just don't separate yourself out and say you're better than the rest of the citizens.
And John Schwanes, to what Nikki was just saying, is will it matter whether or not the General Assembly has a mask mandate if, once we get into session, lawmakers are diligent about this and actually doing what they're supposed to be doing and wearing a mask?
I think it will still get a lot of attention, especially if we continue to see the kinds of spikes that we've seen in recent weeks. And the state is wrestling with this in a fashion that, you know, we wouldn't have imagined last session in terms of the fiscal impact, in terms of the human impact. I think people will be paying attention. You know, it's lawmakers have already exempted themselves from many of the guidelines. Handguns, for instance, you couldn't go in there with a handgun. I don't think Nikki, you're not packing right now. I don't think. But members of the General Assembly can, in fact, carry handguns, as many as they want, on the floor. So they've already carved out an exception. I don't know if they think they can shoot droplets, you know, virus-laden droplets out of the air with their handguns or what. But, you know, and I don't mean to be flippant here, but a lot of this is about nobody's going to tell me what to do sort of sentiment. And so if House leadership had simply told maybe those two lawmakers, you cannot wear a mask on the floor. We will not allow it. Yeah. I'll bet you anything they'd be out there in their masks. From I mean, this is about no one's going to tell me what to do. I'm a Hoosier. I got freedom, and my freedom means if it doesn't say it explicitly in the Constitution, I know the founders were thinking that I could or could not wear a mask at my choosing.
John, they asked John Jacobs, the new state rep from Johnson County, why he wasn't wearing a mask, and his answer was, I think we all need to repent to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ or face his eternal punishment. That was his answer. So I don't think if leadership would have come down on him that he was gonna go, you know what, you're right. To I'm be not fair, saying his answer's wrong. It's just the answer to a different question.
Well, I mean, honestly, if that's your answer to that question, it's probably your answer to every question, so I suppose it makes things easier.
Well, we're going to find out.
Yeah, I suppose. All right, well, time now.
They should kick him out of the caucus, Michael.
Well, he wasn't participating in the caucus meeting on Tuesday. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the Indiana House and Senate make mask wearing mandatory for members during session? I should probably not have written quite so many M's in that sentence. A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, should COVID gathering limits be imposed on houses of worship? 74% of you said they should, 26% say they shouldn't. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana legislative leaders say liability protections around COVID-19 could be the first order of business when the General Assembly starts its new session.
The proposed concept would provide businesses, nonprofits, schools, and healthcare facilities with protections from civil lawsuits. For example, if a person visited a store and then got the virus, they couldn't turn around and sue that store owner. Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray says it's a top priority for the 2021 session.
It's important to try and build back in some confidence to our companies and our charitable organizations and even some other governmental entities so that they can feel like they can get back out there and get back to work.
Leaders of both parties agree that a bill to create those liability protections limited to the pandemic could pass out of the legislature and go to the governor within the first month of session.
And Delaney, legislative leaders have said they've been hearing from a lot of businesses of a lot of different sizes about this issue for months. Is this the right issue to be top of the list for the General Assembly?
Of course it's not. It just shows they're all ostriches. They all have their heads buried in the sand. People are going to lose unemployment compensation in December. They're going to be evicted from their homes in December. We have a crisis in terms of health care, and all of these things are coming due. And do we deal with them? No. We set up a solution in search of a problem. That's what this is. It is basically non-existent. How do you establish that when the virus is as pervasive as it is now, that you got it by going into that convenience store as opposed to the supermarket you went to or the other business, you can't. No lawyer's going to bring that suit. Tell me how many suits have been brought to date. Nobody can even answer that question because it's exactly like voter fraud. It's one of these things they rail against, and it doesn't exist. And what they ought to be doing is dealing with the real problems that people are facing, and instead, they don't want to do that. They don't want to provide solutions. They just want to look symbolic.
Mike O'Brien, is this really necessary? Are a bunch of these lawsuits here, or are they coming?
Well, we see that after every crisis, you know, whether it's we litigated 9/11 damages for decades. So you think about these large national crises we've gone through. They're always followed by lawsuits. And look, the legislature, from a timing standpoint, is it the right decision for the legislature to do it right now? Legislature's not always in session. And so if we come out of this and businesses, so the people that Ann's talking about that employ people, particularly those on the economic margin that are wait staff, hotel staff, if those businesses don't have the confidence that they can reopen within the parameters of what the government has suggested and be protected on the back end, if there's something that comes up, nobody's going back to work, and the legislature needs to do this now. So when we do reopen, and this hopefully in the second half, if we're back to normal in the second half of next year, this is already taken care of. It's not even a question anymore, and it is a question for businesses clearly.
John Schwannis,
we know.
Not according to that.
9/11. This is not 9/11.
It's 9/11 on top of 9/11 on top of 9/11.
We know where it happened. You can't tell where you've been infected.
It's way worse.
All right, John. In the last topic, John, Nikki talked about the perception problem. Is that a little bit of what this is when lawmakers are talking about? This is the first thing on the list, not the only priority, certainly, but we're talking about speeding it through the General Assembly within the first month, potentially, to get it off the plate. Is that a perception problem?
It just seems unnecessary, maybe, to Ann's point. I don't see attorneys lined up ready to file these suits. I think most people are concerned about staying alive and staying out of the hospital and off ventilators at this point. They're really not, maybe with some limited exceptions, thinking about how to profit or gain compensation through our legal system. It just seems maybe odd. But then again, tort reform, of course, is a way to always ring the bell for conservatives in the Republican Party. We've seen it with medical malpractice. We've seen it with any number of issues. And so it's an easy target that plays to a certain segment of the base. Yeah. So from that standpoint, I guess it may not make sense in the overall optics, but if you're appealing to that portion of your base, well, it makes all the sense in the world, I guess.
Nikki, when we talk about the actual policy of this, is it going to be a little tricky to thread the needle so that it's not too broad and you're ruling out lawsuits that maybe you shouldn't rule out?
Yeah, that's the key. I mean, and to be honest, no one I talked to was worried about the customer issue as much as the employee-employer issue. While our economy is still open, there are a ton of businesses who haven't brought their employees back. They're still working from home. And so I think there's a concern there, like if we go all in and bring everyone back and someone gets it, you know, what happens then? But they do need to write it in a way that, you know, if you have some employer who doesn't take any precautions and makes everyone come back and is not flexible at all, you know, if there's actual negligence, someone should be able to sue for that.
Yeah, well, the proof is in the pudding.
I think there's a real question there when you have an employee, and does workers' comp fit in this or not? And nobody seems to be addressing whether workers' comp would compensate lawyers under those employees under those circumstances.
Yeah,
well, in your case, your employees are lawyers, so that works.
There you go. All right.
Well, that's true, too.
Governor Eric Holcomb this week announced his choice for Indiana's first ever appointed education secretary. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports it's Katie Jenner, the governor's senior education advisor.
Katie Jenner has served as Holcomb's education advisor throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. She also serves as a member of the governor's Teacher Compensation Commission. That group is expected to make recommendations for raising teacher pay ahead of the 2021 legislative session. Messages of congratulations and support poured in shortly after the announcement. That includes from the Indiana State Teachers Association, which says Jenner's experience in K-12 education is critical. Jenner was a district and school-level administrator in Madison Consolidated Schools and has experience as a career technical education teacher. Jenner will begin her role as Education Secretary January 11th.
Nikki Kelly, what should we make of this choice?
Well, I mean, she's clearly eminently qualified, and I know that the Indiana State Teachers Association is really happy that she has, you know, classroom and district experience, like, on the ground. We'll have to see, you know, what she does with the position and how she makes it. I have had no sort of one-on-one discussions with her. I do know that when asked questions in briefings in the last couple months, her answers have not been very illuminating, I guess. So hopefully we'll get a little more specific. She'll learn to be a little more specific when we talk to her. But, you know, I wish her luck, and hopefully we'll see how this new post works out.
When we talked about moving from an elected to an appointed Secretary of Education, we've talked about how it really aligns the governor's office with that office in a way that it never really has been before, at least not perfectly. Can't get much more aligned than appointing someone that has been working for you as an education advisor for years, can you, John?
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. If you want that alignment, the thinking, of course, is that Hoosier voters are going to hold the governor accountable for the quality of education in our state, and they have for decades, even though in the past you could have argued that's a different bailiwick with a separately elected official who may or may not even be of the same party. So this does bring that alignment in clear focus. It's somebody the governor is obviously comfortable working with, has a good rapport with, and there's no learning curve there. And I would just say also that, you know, she seems to be an educator and not a political operative. She's not going to be, I don't think, out there, you know, creating, stirring up the pot necessarily with a lot of policy, the way that perhaps others that might have been chosen could have played that role. So I think it's going to be the signal is that it's about pragmatic approach to education and education reform at a time when we certainly need all the support for education, public education we can.
That's absolutely true. Mike O'Brien, no one, I don't think, can question her qualifications here. That is for sure. Nikki called her eminently qualified, and I think that's the best description for it. I wouldn't necessarily call this a flashy choice, but is that a bad thing?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the goal is to pick someone eminently qualified, not get everyone all excited about, you know, someone that's, I don't know her at all. I'm sure she's a wonderful person. But she clearly checks a lot of boxes. She's in classrooms. She's done in the front office. She's worked in policy. From a policy standpoint, she understands it. She understands where the governor's coming from. Operationally, that this someone's gonna have to build this agency, and she's worked in a superintendent's office and knows how to do that too. So that was the point, was to find someone very qualified.
And Ann Delaney, coming with a positive sort of reaction from the Indiana State Teachers Association, if you're a Democrat, does it get much better than that if for a Republican appointee to this position?
I don't, first of all, the Indiana State Teachers Association is run by a Republican, not by a Democrat, number one.
See, we win everything.
Number two, though, it seems to be
leadership of the ISTA.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's because you rig everything. But that's beside the point. It really doesn't matter who he appoints. It really doesn't. Because they've done this, the governor is now responsible for education. If the governor doesn't pay teachers well, if the governor doesn't fund traditional public education K-12, it's the governor's responsibility. He can't push it off on anybody else any longer. And if he doesn't shut down these four profit virtual schools, and if you look sure that you for all the money we have poured into it in the last.
All right, well, we're having some connection issues there with Ann's feed. We are all at the mercy, of course, of our own individual internet connections these days. Moving on, Indiana government has its first ever cabinet officer dedicated to equity and inclusion. Governor Eric Holcomb announced this week he's chosen Kara Herring, to fill the newly created position.
Holcomb first proposed the creation of a diversity officer for his cabinet in August in response to this summer's protests over racial inequity and police brutality. In a statement, he says Herring will help guide every state agency to, in the governor's words, build diversity, and foster an inclusive environment within state government and the services we provide. Herring calls her appointment an incredible opportunity to drive cultural change. She's currently the Director of Public Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. Herring will join state government in her new role February 1st.
John Schwanes, what is a reasonable expectation for Herring as she comes into this job?
Well, I think this is all about recognition and symbolism, and I don't mean that in a negative way at all. It is a recognition on the part of the governor, of the administration, that systemic racism is a problem and needs to be addressed in the highest levels. And so there is that recognition, which is an important first step. Also, it's the notion of awareness to have somebody at that level who can help shine a spotlight. It reminds me a little bit of, what's it been now? Probably 15 years ago, there was the public access counselor. And again, that's minor compared to the notion of inclusion and equal treatment across all races. But it was the notion there was you have somebody in state government for the first time being charged with making sure that government is open to the public, to the people it works for. And this is, I think, the same sort of thing. It's a mirror, to receive feedback, to reflect problems, and perhaps direct attention to issues that either need legislative fixes or administrative fixes.
Nikki, is the biggest trick here going to be how do we evaluate her performance? I mean, this is a huge job. When you're talking about not one agency or three agencies, every state agency, every level of state government, how do you evaluate the effectiveness there?
Yeah, I mean, most agencies have sort of clear metrics that you can assess. And so I really don't know how that's going to be. I think it's going to be a wait and see. One thing I do hope to see out of this office is that it's not just spin. You know, I'm hoping to see, you know, action and not just sort of trying to change our perceptions and really making changes that make certain programs or certain agencies more inclusive.
Yeah. All right. Well, moving on, the NCAA is considering moving all 67 March Madness games to Indianapolis. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports the organization hopes to consolidate venues to reduce risk during the pandemic.
The pandemic has caused NCAA officials to rethink how to run one of its highest revenue tournaments. NCAA Senior Vice President of Basketball Dan Gavitt says the city of Indianapolis, where the organization is also headquartered, has potential to host this season's Division I men's basketball tournament.
We think that that may be our best option if we can work out all the important details around competition venues, practice sites, hotel arrangements, medical resources that are all very available here in Indianapolis.
Gavitt says a lot of work still has to be done with the state and local officials before any final announcement might be made.
Mike O'Brien, simply put, does this feel like a good idea?
It does. Look, there's been examples, the NBA, Major League Baseball, that prove that if you structure this the right way, you can protect everybody and you're disciplined about it. And this isn't even as long as an NBA season. This is a month-long process. It's great for Indianapolis. It's great, hopefully, at a time when we're pivoting out of this and we're seeing mass vaccinations and other things and pivot into a reopening of the convention business in downtown and the lifeblood of the central Indiana economy.
Yeah, economically speaking, I'm sure this is a very exciting prospect. We don't know what the COVID situation is going to look like in March. It could look very different from what it looks like today. Certainly today it doesn't look great. But in that light, Ann Delaney, does this sound like something that will be good for Indiana and Indianapolis?
Oh, it sounds like something that would be great for Indiana and Indianapolis. I mean, so many of us have been home and locked in. The idea that you could be watching actually occur would be and have all the eyes of the country focused in Indianapolis, it seems to me, would be a real plus for the downtown business and for the whole.
And then Nikki Kelly, lastly, 4 months until this would start, is that enough time to figure out all the logistical things we would need to figure out in order to make this work safely?
I think they can figure out the logistics. Obviously, the concern that people have expressed to me is we're going to bring people from 30, 35 other states here. And so sort of the you know, whether you're going to bring the virus in, send the virus back out. It kind of all depends what situation we're in with the COVID-19 in March.
Yeah, I mean, it seems really hard to predict what that's going to be like. But certainly Indianapolis has a history of proving that we can do major events like this. So hopefully this all works out. We'll be keeping our fingers crossed for a lot of reasons from now until March. But that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Have a happy Thanksgiving, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.